I'd like now to welcome to the program Douglas Wissing. He's a historian, a journalist, and author of the book Funding the Enemy, How U.S. Taxpayers Bankroll the Taliban. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So your book begins with a brief history of Afghanistan, which is one of the most fought over regions on the entire planet. And that fighting, it seems, has produced a real warrior culture. What is that culture like? And tell us a little bit about how it got that way.
Well, the Pashtun culture is a 1,000-year-old culture. And it's evolved a warrior culture in the process of just being at the crossroads of Central Asia and fighting off invaders and fighting amongst themselves. And so it has this extraordinary culture that's really based on some cultural cornerstones, such as courage and honor and revenge is a major part of their culture, badal, and also hospitality and being willing to offer hospice to a guest, sometimes even an enemy. So it's a very fascinating culture. It's a complicated culture. There are 350 different tribes in Afghanistan. There are hundreds and hundreds of sub-tribes and tribal groups. So it's a complicated place, but it, particularly among the Pashtun tribe, it does have this warrior culture.
Now, you write about the conflict in Afghanistan during the Soviet Union's involvement there, and it was so interesting to me reading your book to see that the Soviet Union was promoting things like female education and minority group empowerment and fair land distribution. And the conservative factions didn't like that at all, so the United States saw an opportunity, and it supplied these fundamentalists who were anti-woman and all this stuff with arms. And this was part of the creation of the mess that we're still in. Tell us about that period and the whole way the Cold War played out in Afghanistan.
It was really the last chapter of the great game, in a way. The Soviet Union and the United States had been both vying for Afghanistan going back into the 50s, when we had a lot of foreign aid being poured in from both of those empires into Afghanistan. And then when the Soviet war took off in 1979, 1980, in that period, your description is exactly right. The Soviets were trying to be part of modernization, just as they had done in their Islamic Istan republics along the southern belly of the Soviet Union. They were a contemporizing and a modernizing force there. They were trying to do the same thing in Afghanistan. And the conservative aspects, conservative parts of that society rebelled pretty strongly against that modernization effort. And once that took off, the Mujahideen and the jihadist war against the Soviets, the United States, through the CIA, jumped in with both feet. And we supported with tens of millions, hundreds of millions, eventually billions of dollars in aid to these very fundamentalist groups and leaders, including the Haqqanis, who are, of course, now our sworn enemies, and who are the jihadist group that launched the attacks against Kabul and in eastern Afghanistan just recently that threw everything into turmoil. According to the AP, the leader, Jalaluddin Haqqani, visited Ronald Reagan in the White House. These were our boys. Hekmatyar is another one who was a great ally of the CIA and was heavily funded by him. So we set up the madrasas in Pakistan that have generated now another generation of jihadist fighters.
After the Soviet Union pulled out of Afghanistan, there was then a bloody civil war fought in Afghanistan with all the guns left over from the U.S.-Soviet fight. What happened then? What did the power balance look like when that was all over?
Well, there were more personal weapons that were left in Afghanistan for about 30 million people than Pakistan and India combined, that had a population of billions. It was an incredibly heavily armed society. What happened is we just ended up in a terrible bloody war between the Pashtuns and between basically warlords, empowered warlords, and that created an enormous refugee population that had already gotten started during the Soviet War.
How did Afghanistan come to be the world's biggest heroin producer?
Well, I mean, one of the words that I learned in the process of researching Funding the Enemy was a term called parapolitics. Parapolitics is an academic word that relates to what governments do in the shadows. And I'm afraid the CIA was also involved in the growth of the opium trade in Afghanistan, just as they had been in the Golden Triangle during the Vietnam War era. And we were involved with basically opium lords. They were our allies. And when we decided to invade Afghanistan after 9/11, the Taliban had effectively outlawed poppy production in the year just prior to that. The opium production was very low right at that point, which angered the opium lords. Those were our allies. Those warlords were the allies that we turned to when we invaded Afghanistan after 9/11.
It seems that the U.S. is always making these alliances with pretty sketchy allies, drug lords, warlords, fundamentalists. But you, as you say in the book, or as you quote in the book, Afghan loyalty can't be bought. It can only be rented. Give us some examples of that.
Well, Tora Bora, of course, was a great battle that we outsourced to these Afghan warlords. That was the final battle when al-Qaeda was retreating and bin Laden was effectively trapped up in the White Mountains of Afghanistan, right along the Afghan-Pakistani border. And, of course, it's been well documented that those same warlords that we supposedly were renting to fight our war for us were also being paid by al-Qaeda, and they helped al-Qaeda escape, including bin Laden. And those same warlords went on to take pretty lofty positions in the Karzai government.
And this is what happens. I mean, when you talk about what happened in 2001, right after the 9/11 attacks under George Bush, and they were attacking Afghanistan, and they were using Afghan soldiers and renting their loyalty, as you say, and there were more, what was it, there were more journalists in Afghanistan than there were U.S. soldiers?
At Tora Bora, there were more Western journalists than there were soldiers. We had just a few special ops teams that were there. There were literally, out in the mountains, more journalists than American soldiers.
And the U.S. dropped bombs and they dropped food at the same time, which was also not a very successful way of doing things.
Well, we've always gotten this a little commingled, thinking that we can drop bombs and make friends at the same time, and it wasn't very successful. There are tales. I don't know if this happened in Afghanistan or Iraq, where we did the same thing of dropping loads of food at the same time we were invading humanitarian aid. And one place or another, we allegedly crushed somebody with our food drop.
Oh, goodness. So George Bush had what he called a Marshall Plan for Afghanistan. What was that, and what happened to it?
Well, not long after George Bush ordered the invasion of Afghanistan, of course, we got involved in planning to invade Iraq. Before Tora Bora, before that great battle where bin Laden escaped, we were already pulling assets out of Afghanistan, aiming them toward the planning of the invasion of Iraq. And at some point in there, Secretary of State Powell talked George Bush into doing a hearts and minds operation, doing a nation-building operation in Afghanistan. And George Bush had a famous speech at the Virginia Military Institute where he called for a new Marshall Plan in Afghanistan. Let's not forget that Afghanistan is among the very poorest countries on the planet. About $400 a year per capita income, very low caloric intake, effectively a disaster zone. A country that had been at war for 30 years, this was a place that desperately needed rebuilding. And Bush announced a pretty ambitious Marshall Plan. Unfortunately, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld was totally opposed to nation building, and so managed to get everything, you know, the stick in the spokes of the Marshall Plan, and nothing really effectively happened. We did development, but we did it poorly. We did it, we underfunded it, and we, again, outsourced it to some people who were more interested in profit than they were doing good.
We're talking to Doug Wissing about his book, Funding the Enemy, How U.S. Taxpayers Bankroll the Taliban. So one of the problems, the central problem that plays out in so many ways in your book is that you've got the situation. The U.S. basically comes in with a ton of money, and there's a feeding frenzy on the part of everyone, warlords, drug lords, local Afghan governments, U.S. aid agencies, foreign aid agencies, non-governmental organizations, multinational corporations. But it turns out that throwing money at a problem not only doesn't solve it, but sometimes makes it worse. Let's talk about these things, and maybe in some detail. Let's start with the reconstruction efforts, which were sometimes called the hearts and minds efforts, which you describe as a series of unbelievable massive failures. What happened?
Well, we, as you put it, we threw money at the problem. It was a typical bureaucratic response. This is a problem, so let's throw money at it. The insurgency started taking off its nascent parts in 2003, 2004, and the Bush administration decided that the way we would fix it is just to go into a massive development operation. You have to remember, it doesn't take much to totally destabilize a country that is that poor. So we poured development money in with virtually no oversight. By this time, the opium trade was going full force. About 90% of the world's opium, illicit opium, is coming from Afghanistan. That was flooding the market and creating corruption. Then we had all of this aid and development money flooding in, which created an enormous bubble in Afghanistan as all these international organizations and for-profit development companies came thundering in, desperate to grab that money. And it just created this vast bubble that fueled global levels of kleptocracy. Afghanistan very quickly became one of the most corrupt countries on the planet. Give you a quick example, if I can, of just how this system works. Because when I was out in eastern Afghanistan, when I was embedded with soldiers, they began telling me that we were wasting tens of millions of American taxpayer dollars each year on the war with scandalously mismanaged aid and logistics contracts. And at first that seemed silly. And then they started telling me that there was this toxic system that connected distracted American officials, the private U.S. corporations, corrupt Afghan insiders, and the Taliban. We'd be riding around in Taliban country in these massive armored vehicles, and the soldiers would be telling me that we're funding our own enemy. We're financing both sides of the war. It was hard to get my head around. And when I got back, I started digging into it, interviewing hundreds of people, reading a mountain of government documents and white papers and media reports, and I concluded they were right. This system is now so routinized that there are Taliban business offices in Kabul and Kandahar. You get a U.S. contract, you take it there and negotiate with the Taliban engineer to determine what their take is. There's a famous road in eastern Afghanistan, the Host-Gardez Highway. This is a 64-mile-long road. The contract went out to what people call the Beltway Bandits, the Lewis Berger Group and another group called the Black and Veatch. These are American corporations that specialize in this kind of development work, sometimes conflict zone development work. The 64-mile-long road is a skinny two-lane. It's going to end up costing American taxpayers about $176 million. That is $2.8 million a mile for a little two-lane in an area where people make dimes on the hour. So there's a lot of money sloshing around. The way that the money makes it over to the Taliban very commonly is through the security part of the contract, which in Afghanistan, because it's a war zone, runs from 25 to 40%. It just goes to security. In this case, $43 million of that contract went for security, and the security was eventually subcontracted to a known insurgent leader, to a man who was on our special ops kill or capture list. We ended up paying him $160,000 a month to protect the road from himself.
Oh, my goodness. And so that's the part, that's the subtitle of your book. That's how money actually goes from my pocket here in Santa Fe, New Mexico, into the pockets of people in the Taliban.
Yeah, and it operates. That's a big contract. I've seen it operate down on very tiny contracts, relatively tiny contracts, down to humanitarian aid that shows up in the villages, and they put it all aside for the Taliban to come and get the blankets and the medicine. You know, I've seen it on your relatively small little rubble dam projects where it's a project that's in Taliban country. It's never attacked because literally the Taliban, who are 2 kilometers away, are just waiting for payday.
Not only do you have money going into the hands of the Taliban, but you also have all of these unbelievably bungled projects. So schools without teachers, clinics without doctors or medicine, no view to the sustainability of projects, buildings falling apart 2 years after they're built. There was one, what was it called? The Rabia Balkhi Women's Hospital. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the Rabia Balkhi Women's Hospital is among the things that I ran across that really was disturbing to me. And it has to do with what I found to be such an enormous diversion from what is said at behind podiums in Washington and what the on-the-ground reality is in Afghanistan. There is a Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Davis has been in the news quite a bit, who was a whistleblower about what he termed the truth deficit, the difference between what we hear and what the on-the-ground reality is in Afghanistan. And I thought his term of truth deficit was really descriptive. So the Rabia Balkhi Women's Hospital was a good example of this, where you had the U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary, Tommy Thompson, got engaged in making this hospital a premier modern hospital in Afghanistan. This is back in 2003. And he announced that we were going to make this great place for Afghan women to receive, this is his term, top-notch health care. And he showed up for the ribbon cutting. You know, American, you know, everybody always wants to show up for ribbon cuttings. So they partnered, the Health and Human Services partnered with the Defense Department on a project to refurbish the hospital and train the staff in modern American traditions. And they determined that the answer was cesarean births. Afghanistan has a really big problem with infant mortality, second highest in the world. So, you know, gosh, this seems so good on the surface. So the problem was, is there was virtually no sanitation in this hospital. People were defecating in the corner. The afterbirths were trucked out by wheelbarrows and dumped outside the hospital, and they only cleaned them up once a week. I mean, this is the third world. This is deep into virtually close to undeveloped. So we start doing these cesarean births. Women are given births on plastic sheets one after the other. The infection rate, I had a public health fellow, actually a civil affairs officer, a man named Colonel Dan Reina, who is an extraordinary guy, who's a public health official in New Mexico. He works a lot with the issues of poverty and bringing health care into those kinds of situations. They put him in charge of this, and he was telling me that there was a 67% jump in infant deaths. The infection rate was 100%. Colonel Reina told me, he said, it was just horrible. And at the same time that this is happening, Tommy Thompson was running around giving speeches telling people that we were just doing this extraordinary thing. And Dan Reina, he told me, he said, again, this is a quote, we're telling them we're bringing hope and health to Afghan women, but that just wasn't the case. They weren't developing the Afghans. They were developing themselves. I hope I never have to see any of that again.
We're talking to Doug Wissing about his book, Funding the Enemy, How U.S. Taxpayers Bankroll the Taliban. What about the idea of building a modern hospital? Did they just forget to put running water in it? I mean, how could that have happened?
Things were so sketchy. It was all about burn rate. Do you know this term, burn rate?
Yeah.
This is about spending your budget. And so we would bring people in on ridiculously short rotation cycles, 3 months, 6 months. They were very ambitious careerists. They wanted to come in and punch their ticket. And so I had one guy tell me, he said, it's all spend, spend, spend. You got 6 months to add a line to your resume. And that was the way it was. There was no sustainability. There was no real thought of that that I could see. In some cases, yeah, but in general, it was all about the press release. It was all about the ribbon cutting.
Even some projects that were as apparently benign as drilling wells caused disasters. Tell us about that.
Well, we drilled tens of thousands of wells, and one of the big problems you talked about, the schools without teachers, the clinics without medics. We would build things, but we wouldn't ask, oh, are there any teachers? Oh, are there any doctors? Are there any nurses? You know, we were hell-bent for leather. And another thing that happened that was totally uncoordinated was well drilling. We drilled tens of thousands of tube wells around Afghanistan without any coordination. The military drilled them, USAID drilled them, the UN drilled them, NGOs drilled them. You know, three neighbors of yours in New Mexico would get together and send money out to drill a well. And on the face of it, it seems completely benign. You put folks in New Mexico, I think because of your water issues and long tradition of understanding how you do things in a dry land, are probably much more sensitive than most Americans. But in Afghanistan, we drilled so many wells, we literally lowered the water table. So fields that had been arable for as long as anyone could remember could no longer be used. Eventually, the U.S. Geological Survey did a study that was trying to determine the age of the water in the aquifer underneath Kabul, because we were drilling wells all over Kabul as that population exploded, as people moved to the city to get out of the war zone. And they discovered that the water that we were pumping was 20,000 years old. We were effectively mining the water.
Right.
And we were coming in thinking it was an aquifer that replenishes like it does, you know, in most of America. I had a hydrologist tell me, she said, we're just heading toward a disaster there. There's an incredibly dramatic story coming up.
And I have to say, we have similar problems here in New Mexico and in the entire West, the problem of mining water. But in Afghanistan, failures like that, and indeed every failure you're talking about, not only doesn't win hearts and minds, but it's fodder for the Taliban PR machine.
Yeah, there are some great soldiers out there, and great civilian officials. I met some just amazing people. And they understood the problems, and they were trying to deal with them. The complication for them is they were always dealing with a really broken system. Many of the things that I'm describing, those people are the ones that told me about it. There is a vast amount of on-the-ground wisdom there. It just doesn't tend to make its way into policy decisions.
You gave one or two examples in the book of how U.S. development money hurt traditional cultures. Give us an example of that.
There's an anthropologist named Louis Dupree, and his partner and his widow is a woman named Nancy Hatch Dupree. And Nancy is in her 90s, is still incredibly vital, has been working in Afghanistan, I think, since the 1950s, is still running an important program there and is amazingly dynamic. And she was talking about how there used to be a very traditional way for Afghans to maintain the irrigation canals and to take the rubble out of the canals, take the rubble out of the rivers so that irrigation continued. And it was a communal effort, and people would come down from the villages, and it was a holiday. It was effectively a party, as all these diverse groups would come together with communal labor to fix something. And then we came in and started doing projects that were called cash for work. The theory being that if we paid people, they wouldn't fight against us, which, you know, is of course an unproven thesis. But we started these projects where we would pay people to clean out the canals, the thing that they'd always done as part of their communal work. And very soon, Afghans stopped cleaning their irrigation canals unless they were paid to do it.
So much of Afghanistan became, as you are telling us, a stage for career advancements, spending budgets rather than having a thought-out plan, a feeding frenzy for dollars. Why was there no strategy or oversight or measurement? I mean, was there really just nobody in charge? Was there nobody thinking about this?
I think we were operating from a position of arrogance, and our military was really terribly distracted by Iraq, which was the big show, and we didn't think Afghanistan mattered. And while we were distracted with Iraq, the insurgency was gaining in power year by year. There was a certain denial going on, I think, almost some sort of psychological denial going on. But on the ground, people were saying, this insurgency's taken off again. We're seeing training camps again. We're seeing, you know, the attacks are climbing. We started seeing suicide bombers and IEDs for the first time. But we were focused on Iraq.
Were there any successful projects at all that you saw when you were researching Afghanistan?
That's an excellent question. And I wish I should have a list of three, but I don't. Most of the things, there is a concept called phantom aid that is like parapolitics. This is a term that's used in the development community. And it has to do with money that is aimed toward improving poor people's lives, but instead it gets eaten up in the overhead for development companies, for international organizations, for all kinds of things, and nothing gets to the people. For instance, in Afghanistan, we spent well over $60 billion in aid and development, but the estimate is only about 10% of that money has actually made it to the Afghan people. Most of it's been wasted on corruption and grotesque money grabs. And it's just the way that it has gone, not just in Afghanistan, but in parts of Africa. It's the same kind of story. The overhead eats up a lot, and payoffs and skims and whatnot. And it's just the story. I'll give you an example. Once I was out in a province called Ghazni, and I met a conflict zone development officer, a British guy, and he was telling me, that he was telling me these various stories, and he started telling me about the Afghan chicken scam. And all over Afghanistan, you have these poultry development projects. It's just a classic thing. It's a contract that goes to Western development contractors to train Afghan women often. It's often a women's empowerment kind of thing in basic poultry techniques. And so you have this organization in Washington, a Beltway bandit, gets this contract from USAID, and it sounds good on the face of it. And so they take their cut, they subcontract it to somebody else, they take their 20%, they subcontract it to somebody else. And eventually you have this pretty poorly trained Afghan subcontractor on the ground training a group of Afghan women in chicken raising, you know, a few days' classes. Most of the Afghan women receive a little bit of money to attend, so they, you know, it's a good gig for them. Following the training, the women get a flock of chickens and a rooster. And so, again, it's like, oh, well, you know, this isn't so bad. But things never go right in Afghanistan. What most women do is they very quickly take their chickens to the marketplace. A few of them do keep them, but we don't do a good job of really giving them enough stuff to sustain it. And so most of those chickens die. This British development officer, he estimated that 80 to 90% of these incredibly expensive projects, the poultry development projects, fail. And he started talking about one particularly extravagant project, and he said, it would have been cheaper to have parachuted chickens out of an airplane with a year's worth of food.
We're talking to Doug Wissing about his book, Funding the Enemy, How U.S. Taxpayers Bankroll the Taliban. So we see that the point of all of these billions and billions of U.S. taxpayer dollars that are spent in Afghanistan was to weaken the insurgent groups there, to weaken the Taliban. But not only is it not working, it's actually doing the opposite.
Yeah, we're in a situation where U.S. taxpayers are funding both sides of the war. And it's an entrenched system now. And it's going to be really hard to break that apart.
Who are the insurgency? Who are the Taliban? What are their goals? What do they look like now, 10 years later?
The term that's often used about the Afghan insurgency is the neo-Taliban. These aren't your father's Taliban. These are new groups that are, in some cases, still have leadership that go back to the old Taliban, but it's often much younger leaders, and Mullah Omar is still there. But there are these other insurgent groups, such as the Haqqani Network and the Hekmatyar group. And there's other groups that have rough alliances. It's just kind of an umbrella group. They loosely cooperate, but it's a Hydra-headed insurgency. It's based on religious fundamentalism. Sometimes it's based on anti-foreign nationalism. Sometimes it's based on just criminal networks that use that to operate. It's all mixed together.
As I was reading this, I was thinking about the difference between the culture, for example, of drug kingpins in a big American city and the kind of war zones that these neighborhoods are, and the culture of essentially civilization where there's something resembling the rule of law, which we tend to take for granted and live by in middle-class United States of America. And what it seems like we're doing there is accepting, condoning, and propping up the equivalent of a gigantic mafia, military and drug mafia, that we are part of, and that's the reality.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of validity in what you're saying. We're making alliances of convenience that supposedly are going to work out, but they end up being not the best choice when it comes around. You know, we put a little bit of time into it, and then what do you have but a major problem? I spoke with a man who's an international narcotics expert, a man named Rensselaer Lee. And Lee said, we've consistently made alliances for larger strategic reasons with warlords who grow opium. And the problem is that then when we allow those people to take power, to take political power, then soon you've got a country awash in opium and heroin, and you've also given them all the power. So in the short run, you can use it to try to accomplish things. But in the long term, you're going to have that money help finance the Taliban. Rensselaer Lee said to me, he said, that's an invitation to political suicide. You can't build a country on opium. And these convenient alliances have just come back to bite us time and time again.
And then there are these failed attempts at alternative livelihood programs where they're dropping wheat, they're airdropping wheat, and the bags of wheat break open, and you can't make money off of wheat anyway because they're giving away free flour and bread. I mean, it's yet another one of those non-workable ways of approaching it, trying to get rid of the drug trade somehow through offering alternative livelihoods that aren't workable.
Yeah, there was such a tremendous lack of coordination between these American and international agencies. Sometimes, and even within the military, the special ops teams were operating completely independently of the regular, you know, big army and the development team. So, for instance, in some cases, we would fly into what they term a red zone, a Taliban-controlled area, to talk to village farmers about growing better wheat or something. Well, the night before, a special ops team would have been in the same village killing people, so the villagers wouldn't exactly be ready to talk about some warm and fuzzy hearts and minds project. And we would fly in, be dropped off hours before a retaliation attack was going to happen. I'm talking as being part of a development team, just to let your listeners know. And the reality was we had to try and get the Blackhawks back as quick as we could because the shells are going to start flying any minute.
How much money has been spent so far in Afghanistan?
Well, President Obama referenced $1 trillion not long after bin Laden was killed. The meter's running pretty fast. We're spending about $2 billion a week right now. We spent $120 billion a year or last year. Again, this is a country where 97% of the gross domestic product is foreign aid. There's virtually no economy there. It's a staggering amount of money when we think about the needs that we have here. There was a study done at Brown University where they think the total cost of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, once we get all the costs in, Veterans Administration and things of that nature, is going to be about $4 trillion. Just to give you a few references, $120 billion, which is what we spent last year, that would buy 15.5 million university scholarships or 1.9 million elementary school teachers, their annual salaries. So as our bridges are falling down, as we can't educate the young or take care of the old, we need to think about this. Certainly the soldiers out in Afghanistan, many are making these kinds of connections. I remember one guy who was anguishing about spending hundreds of thousands of dollars, which is just peanuts in Afghanistan. The money figures that we throw at these projects is staggering. He was anguishing about hundreds of thousands of dollars on orchards, and he was talking about his school back in the Midwest where the kids didn't have books and wondering, how can we afford to do this when we can't do that? And I think those are all wonderful questions.
I was thinking about that, too, so much while reading your book because, I mean, here we are in Santa Fe, which is a relatively wealthy community, and we're continually having these little fundraisers to buy crayons for the schools and things like that. And when you think about the fundraisers that we are continually having here for public education, it's essentially a voluntary tax on the part of citizens of the United States to pay for things that, instead of going to public education and infrastructure and so on, is going to totally failed projects in a country that's not functioning.
Yeah, I think I understand sacrifice. And certainly the soldiers out there understand sacrifice. But you'd like to think it went for a good cause. And what we have seen with this counterinsurgency strategy is there is virtually no connection between the development work that we've done and a reduction in security. The special forces have long had a dictum that says if an insurgency isn't shrinking, it's winning. We've seen that insurgency grow virtually every year since we've been there. Last year, there were 16,000 IEDs planted in Afghanistan. Afghanistan's about the size of Texas. So can you imagine 16,000 buried bombs in Texas? And that number has doubled every few years. It grew 10%. That's a staggering number of IEDs being planted. And each one of those IEDs involves a really complicated network of people, broad swaths of the Afghan society, the smugglers, the bomb makers, the people who plant them, the people who shelter them. You're really talking about a representative operation that encompasses a lot of people.
If the goal of the insurgency was to bankrupt the United States, they're really quite successful in their goal, aren't they?
Well, something that people don't understand, I don't think, is that this was always Osama bin Laden's strategy, was to bleed until bankrupt. He would talk about, this was an economic war. He'd talk about having an al-Qaeda operative wave a flag over there and then watch the American generals stampede over there. And then somebody else waves an al-Qaeda flag over there and the generals rush over there. He called it the bleed until bankruptcy plan. And, you know, when we killed him, his plan was working like a charm. We had 100,000 soldiers there. We were spending $10 billion a month, you know, at the same time that we were struggling here. And it's a brilliant strategy. It's kind of insurgency 101, and once again, we're flunking the course.
There's another dimension to it also that I was thinking about, which is that when in the United States you reduce the amount of money that's available for education, you have a poor economy, you have ever-increasing inequality, and of course part of that inequality is we're paying taxes, and the money is not only being wasted in Afghanistan on the ground, but it's also going to multinational corporations who then are not really giving it back in terms of taxation. Okay, so you have all those things. You're creating fertile ground for having even more drug addiction, including heroin addiction, which is also coming from Afghanistan.
Well, I don't know if this is good news or bad news, but from what I have seen, most of the Afghan heroin doesn't make it to the United States. It goes to Europe, it goes to Iran, it goes to the former Soviet republics, more to Europe than to here. Some, as I understand it, does make its way here, but this is not the prime market for that heroin.
Now, when Obama came into office, he inherited the biggest mess that he could have imagined. What policies has he pursued, and have they been different from what Bush was doing before?
What it appears to me is Obama effectively put the Bush plan on steroids. He did that bureaucratic thing of throwing money at a problem. We funded both counterinsurgency and counterterrorism. They've always been a little linked, but I didn't see a lot of new thinking there. It was, to a certain extent, the military had him in a corner because he had made Afghanistan one of his primary planks in his run for the presidency. It was his security platform. So the military used it and got the funding, got the troops that they wanted.
Doug, tell us about the situation of, I mean, so many people have died, both people of Afghanistan and American soldiers, and there's been so many people been wounded and traumatized. What does that look like on both sides?
Well, there's been about 2,000 soldiers killed in Afghanistan, and then beyond that, there's tens of thousands of soldiers that have been wounded, lost legs, lost limbs. I recently interviewed a representative Walter Jones of North Carolina, whose district includes the Marine base at Camp Lejeune. And Representative Jones has become an outspoken advocate of faster withdrawal from Afghanistan. And when I talked to him, he said to me, "I just got back from visiting Walter Reed Hospital." He said, "I was visiting three of my constituents, three Marines. None of them have legs. I have four constituents that have no body parts below their waist. There is just air there, sir," he said. And he said, I've sent out 10,462 condolence letters. And he just wants us to get out. He read me a letter from a Marine general who was urging us to get out. And I'm going to read you something from a Marine Corps colonel who spoke with me not too long ago. And he said, this is a quote, "Among the Marines in Afghanistan, there's low morale. They say, this is such a waste of time. This is a drug and tribal war with the Iranian and the Pakistani intelligence services involved." He said, on an operational level, the soldiers are saying, "I'm going to go over there and try to not get my legs blown off. My nation will shut this down. That's the feeling of my fellow soldiers." And he concluded, he said, "The juice ain't worth the squeeze."
When you look at the whole situation, if you could turn back the clock, and I know this isn't your job, you're a historian and journalist, not a policymaker, but what could have been done differently?
Well, what folks have told me is that there was a golden hour very early after we invaded. With the Afghans, again, it's a tribal culture, it's a warrior culture. One of the cornerstones of that culture is revenge. So within the Pashtun community, they understood us invading after 9/11. Of course, there's, you know, going to be resistance, but on some deep cultural level, they understood that. And they expected us to then follow through and do the things we promised. And we didn't do that. We pulled out our security forces. We aimed at Iraq. We didn't follow through with what we promised with development. And what we did do was often siphoned away, either in corruption or in the overhead of the development corporations. I was in a meeting up in Taliban country with a group of tribal villagers with a development team. It was a meeting in a little fortified government center, and one of these tribal leaders just sitting around with a bunch of Afghans who are wearing bandoliers and carrying battered old automatic weapons, and one of the tribal leaders said through the interpreter, "You know, we heard on Voice of America News that America spent billions here." He said, "We haven't seen any in our village. Where'd the money go?" And the commander of the team, who's a very honest guy, said, "I don't know. We don't know where the money went either." And I think if we had followed through with what we said, if we had provided security, if we had done basic, smart, sustainable development in conjunction with the Afghans, if we hadn't let it turn into a feeding frenzy, back 2003, 2002, early 2004, we really might be looking at a much different situation.
And what is to be done now, given the reality?
Well, I can report what U.S. troops and development officers and other people that have, you know, I view as experts, and what they have told me is now really the only way to end this excessive government waste, to end this system, is just to get out of Afghanistan. The toxic system is just too deeply rooted. People seem to be saying they don't know anymore. We see a lot of plans coming out of Washington, but someone told me, an old Afghanistan hand taught me a new word the other day. He said it's a very popular word in that group, and it's called reify. Do you know reify? R-E-I-F-Y.
Right.
I didn't know that term, and what he told me is it means confusing a concept with reality. And we have these grand plans, grand strategies. We've had no end of grand plans and grand strategies. An ambassador who was there, Ronald Newman, a very smart guy, has said, you know, we've always had great strategies. Our problem has been execution. We change strategies once a year. You know, it's the strategy du jour.
Do you have any hope, or is our only hope to basically get out, stop spending money there, and let the chips fall where they may? In other words, what would happen if we just got out? It would just be a Taliban-run country again?
It's more likely there would be another serious civil war. The reality is much higher that that's what's going to be the result here. Yeah, the sense I have is that we're going to be responsible for trying to help out with humanitarian aid and do our part to help out with almost an inevitable disaster that's upcoming.
Doug Wissing is a historian, journalist, and he's the author of the book Funding the Enemy, How U.S. Taxpayers Bankroll the Taliban. His website is douglaswissing.com. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much. It's been enjoyable.